Hi, this is Janice Torres from Yo Quiero Dinero. From a local business to a global corporation, partnering with Bank of America gives your operation access to exclusive digital tools, award-winning insights, and business solutions so powerful, you'll make every move matter. Visit bankofamerica.com/bankingforbusiness to learn more. What would you like the power to do? Bank of America N.A. Copyright 2024.
The Economist. Hello and welcome to The Intelligence from The Economist. I'm your host, Jason Palmer. Every weekday, we provide a fresh perspective on the events shaping your world. Piecing together the supply chain behind Russia's war machine is not easy, with all that cooking of the books and hiding behind shell companies. We dig through some new data that suggest many of the imports lead back to one country. And our columnist examines the reliable agony of trying to work during a flight. First up, though, in a country as populous as India, a general election takes a while to complete. Over 6 weeks and seven stages, hundreds of millions of people will get to the polls. Yesterday, the latest phase began, and in the state of Gujarat, Prime Minister Narendra Modi himself cast a ballot before greeting crowds of cheering supporters. This year, Mr. Modi is expected to walk to a record-equaling third term at the head of his Bharatiya Janata Party, or BJP. That ease is partly a reflection of his brand of politics, but also of his reputation for prosperity. Simply put, lots of Indian voters think he's helping the country get rich, and there are reasons to believe that. It's already the world's fifth-largest economy, and on track to get to third by 2027. Private sector confidence is at its highest since 2010. Poverty is down. But there are also questions over whether India's success can last and whether Mr. Modi really has all that much to do with it.
India is doing reasonably well, but it's not the next China.
Arjun Ramani is our global business and economics correspondent.
So it's growing at around 6 to 6.5%, which makes it the fastest growing major economy in the world. But if you were to look at China or the Asian tigers when they were this rich, they were growing at 10 plus percent. It's not bad, but it's not superstar.
Well, let's look first at why it's not bad, why it's good, in fact. What's behind the economic successes that India can count?
So there are a few things. I think the big story of the past decade has been the build-out of digital and physical infrastructure, as well as the creation of a single national market. So with infrastructure, you've had a huge road building, bridge building program. You're getting power infrastructure to 15 gigawatts of solar energy capacity a year. And then digital infrastructure, which is quite interesting. So India has a national identity scheme that started in 2006, but now everyone has been given a bank account linked to that ID. And so you can do digital payments that 300 million people here do monthly. And then there was a big consumption tax that was passed in 2016, which basically knit together a patchwork of state-level systems. And so that's made it a lot easier to do commerce across state boundaries, creating what some people are calling a truly single market. So that's the infrastructure. And then I would say beyond that, a second thing to look at is its mix of exports. I think services are really where India shines. They have reached 10% of GDP in terms of exports. You may have heard of companies like Infosys or TCS, Tata Consultancy Services. These are some of the biggest IT companies in the world. They were founded in India. A lot of corporations will do back office operations through these IT firms. And increasingly, they're moving up the value chain into front office services. Firms are creating what people call global capability centers. Microsoft and Google have these things, and they're providing a lot of high value add jobs. That's what's really driving Indian growth.
So I guess the question is how much of this success you can pin on the leadership of Narendra Modi?
It's a hotly debated question. India has been growing around 5.6% per year under Modi, which is actually a slight slowdown compared to previous governments. But you can't really blame him for that because global growth slowed down during that period. India had a financial crisis due to bad debts in the 2000s. In terms of what Modi's done, he hasn't had that many original ideas. He's basically taken ideas that were in the Indian economic policy sphere. So we mentioned the infrastructure push, we mentioned digital infrastructure, but he does deserve credit for actually executing these types of reforms and pushing them through the bureaucracy. A lot of industrialists will compare him to a CEO, finding bottlenecks in the system and clearing those hurdles to actually implement these types of big projects. Some accuse him of fostering crony capitalism, and there is some truth to that. But if you actually look at overall corporate concentration, it's surprisingly fallen. Business dynamism has increased, and I think perhaps the accusation of crony capitalism is overstated. And I think the forecasts are probably roughly correct. India will probably grow at a pretty strong rate, 6.5% over the next 5 years. Its upper middle class will probably grow as well.
Now, with all of that said, though, you hinted that there are some problems perhaps underlying all of this growth.
India faces daunting problems. I think the biggest one has to do with the labor market. So out of 1 billion working age people, only around 100 million or so have formal jobs. Most of the rest are probably in casual work, underemployed, or jobless. If you were able to get this maybe half the population that is out of the labor force or still in agriculture, working in more productive jobs or sectors, you could really raise the overall growth. And so I think that's what the government is trying to do. And so they have this state-run incentive scheme called production-linked incentives that's intended to promote manufacturing. And so basically gives you subsidies if you meet sales targets. So far, though, it's not really had a huge impact. Even if it achieves its targets, it will only create around 7 million jobs. There's some bright spots, like Apple iPhones are increasingly assembled in India. But if you look at overall manufactured exports, they haven't really increased. And Chinese competition is actually increasing right now. They're subsidizing manufacturing again, making things harder for India.
So it sounds like the initiatives underway aren't going to address this big problem with the labor market that you lay out. What would?
One part of the puzzle is getting some manufacturing, but you can't depend on a Chinese-style manufacturing boom. It's just much harder now. The sector is much more automated and less labor-intensive. So where can you compete? So one path would be a much bigger services sector, especially in IT. You generate a bunch of surplus wealth, and that spills over into supporting jobs, such as in other services like retail, like construction, hotels, and so forth. And if you have this big, efficient single market, maybe that raises overall productivity. I'm skeptical that gets you all the way, which is why the new welfare system, which is using these digital payment rails with these bank accounts to send money directly to people without much leakage, could help those who fall behind. But even for this system, which isn't perfect, but is better than the current one, you do need to transform the education system and move beyond agriculture. And that requires a lot of hard governance reforms. For example, finding ways to get people to shift en masse from agricultural areas into cities. But obviously, that's very difficult unless you have well-run, well-managed cities. But I think those are the challenges ahead.
Where again we come up against this question of Narendra Modi and his abilities and influence himself, his party. What do you reckon? Is the BJP up to the task of making the reforms you describe?
It's unclear. So over the past decade, Modi has shown impulses in the direction of reform. He tried to reform agriculture in 2021, get rid of a lot of subsidies, make it more of a market-based system. But basically, there was a bunch of protests. He didn't consult anyone, and he yielded. And I think that's happened in other ways, too. So we talked about reforming cities and city governance and shifting more power to them so they can autonomously govern themselves to an extent. Those types of reforms require a lot of consensus building. Convincing state governments that, hey, if you want your cities to work, you got to give them a bit more power. Modi has not shown that to be a priority. And so I think you could argue that an excessive focus on ideology, centralization of power, focus on these big business investments has perhaps distracted from these harder governance reforms. There's also the risk that the illiberalism actually pushes India backwards. If you look at the corporate sector and you talk to industrialists, some of them will say in private that, hey, if I were to speak out against this government, I'm going to get a call the next day and be forced to basically take back my statement. So I think there's a sense in which maybe the reason for lack of private investment is a lack of free speech. So I think there is a connection between the political style and these types of economic changes. for things like infrastructure, the centralized approach works, but for hard governance reform where you require consensus building, it's not the best. And so I think his politics will have to evolve for India to stay in its growth in the longer term.
Arjun, thanks very much for your time.
Thank you, Jason.
What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico is more than just a tropical paradise. It's an innovations paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, Puerto Rico has the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, this is the place to bring it. Find out more at investpr.org/economist.
More than 2 years into Russia's invasion of Ukraine, there's just no let-up in the fighting. Every day there's an exchange of bullets, artillery shells, rockets. Despite Western sanctions, Russia is not only able to replenish its military supplies, its arms industry is booming. So where and how is it getting all of that weaponry?
Russia's production of crucial weapons for the war effort in Ukraine has dramatically increased since the start of the fighting.
Oliver Jones is a news editor at The Economist.
The West has introduced huge sanctions against Russia and particularly its arms industry. And so Russia has been trying to find different places from where it can source the parts, the electronics, and the tools that are needed to create the weapons that it needs. And a recent study from the Center for Strategic and International Studies, which is a think tank in Washington, found that actually a lot of these parts are increasingly coming from China.
Parts for weapons, not weapons themselves.
So China says that it's neutral in the war and that it doesn't provide weapons to either side. But what it is providing Russia is the sort of small components that are needed to make these weapons. So we're talking semiconductors and chips. We're talking parts for navigation equipment, other electronics and guidance systems. And we're also talking the tools, the high-precision manufacturing equipment that is needed to make critical hardware.
Do you say the amount that China has been providing to Russia has increased since the start of the war?
Yeah, so it has. But there are two really key moments, I think, to understand when this process really began to increase and to take place more often. The first is when Vladimir Putin announced the partial mobilization of Russia in September 2022. And that was the moment where he really began to gear up the Russian economy and Russian society for the war effort. And then the second and probably most striking thing in terms of when these imports really began to increase from China is Xi Jinping's visit to Russia and his meeting with Vladimir Putin in March 2023. And that was the moment when we really begin to see a huge increase in the amount of these parts that are coming from Chinese companies. China is clearly really important. We've seen that Antony Blinken, America's Secretary of State, has called it the primary contributor to Russia's defense industry. However, we are also seeing that despite all of these sanctions, parts from Western countries are still getting through to Russia. And that's because they're going through third countries that are not taking part in Western sanctions regimes, such as the United Arab Emirates and Turkey. And you can see the countries that are providing these weapons and the scale of it on our graph in the graphic details section of economist.com.
This seems to be another version of the story in which essentially sanctions aren't doing what they're supposed to do. Russia is getting what it needs for its war effort by hook or by crook.
Yes, that's true in some ways. But it's important to acknowledge, I think, that the way that we enforce these sanctions is complicated and is in some ways getting increasingly so. So Russia is increasingly using less advanced systems on the battlefield because it's running out of the more advanced ones. It's also beginning to seek out technology that is used not only for military purposes, but also for civilian ones too. And that makes it very hard, I think, for sanctions regimes to track international supply chains and essentially to enforce these restrictions. And it's also true that China's manufacturing capacity is huge, and it is a supplier to some Ukrainian arms development as well, although it's important to say that that's much lesser than its supply to Russia. So when the Western countries are thinking about how to enforce these sanctions, they also have to consider that enforcing sanctions against Chinese companies could in some way impede some of Ukraine's military procurement as well.
Thanks very much for your time, Ollie.
No problem. Thanks very much, Jason.
please. Passengers are allowed only one carry-on bag and one personal item, such as a purse, briefcase, or laptop.
You're not important enough to turn left when you get on a plane.
Andrew Palmer, no relation, writes Bartleby, our column on the world of work.
But you are important enough for your company to want you to have completed a project risk update by the time you land. You have 6 solid hours in the air, and the work should take no more than 3. You're not in a middle seat, and no one can email you. What could possibly go wrong? You find your seat, which is on the aisle. You take out your laptop and a book and try to put them into the seat pocket in front of you. It's made for someone who has absolutely no interests, but you manage, with some effort, to shove both of them in. As the plane fills up, your hopes of space around you go down. You scan the people heading down the aisle. So does everyone else already in a seat. In this moment, each passenger is being silently judged on only 2 criteria: girth and proximity to a baby. Eventually, you get up to make way for a couple to sit beside you. Could have been worse. You waste the first hour of the flight just faffing about. There's a surprising amount to do. You go through every film in the onboard menu 3 times, surprised anew by how so much choice can yield so little enthusiasm. You stir pepper into a tomato juice while wondering what is supposed to be happening as a result. The grains remain on the surface, unmoved by your efforts. You eat a tiny bag of pretzels as slowly as you can, and you fall dramatically and briefly asleep. Eventually, it's time. You attempt to remove the laptop and find it is completely wedged into the seat pocket. You tug at it, without success. You pull harder, nothing. And more violently still, until your grip suddenly loosens and your elbow flies back into the hand of the passenger next to you, the hand holding a glass, also of tomato juice. You apologize wildly.
Oh gosh, I'm so sorry. I'm so sorry.
They're nice about it, but a palpable air of disgrace now hangs over seat 42H. You carefully pull back the seat pocket with your left hand as far as you can and manage to lever the laptop out. To your right, there's a lot of murmuring and the dabbing of napkins. You place the laptop on the tray table, turn the computer on, and remember just how little room there is on a plane. You tuck your elbows in, and your hands dangle in front of you. You look like a T-Rex about to take dictation. Your neighbour immediately asks if she can get past. So you retrace your movements, closing the laptop, folding the table, putting things away. In the galley, you can see the crew readying the trolleys for lunch. Give it another hour, you think. The meal passes without incident. You drink wine from a can, and for some reason think this is a treat. You start to watch a film about a gorilla and a monster. You have no interest in this kind of thing normally, but it turns out to be truly excellent. The gorilla wins, or the monster does, or perhaps they both do. You have 3 hours to go. The laptop comes out again, but by now the person in front of you has put their seat back. With your own seat reclining and the tray table pulled right out, you can have the screen open at an acute angle of around 60 degrees. You know that it's important that strangers cannot read company documents over your shoulder, but reading it for yourself would be nice. You type a sentence, pick up the laptop, and angle the screen away from you to read Ragstedses, 3 Ridden, 7 Amster, 2 Groin. You spend the next 2 hours typing blindly. Occasionally, you pick the laptop up again to check on what you're writing. You know what everything means, but others would struggle to understand. It reads as though you're heroically drunk. You'll have to go through everything again at the hotel. Suddenly, a noise. You peer at the screen and see that your laptop has announced that its battery levels are critical. Before you can think to yourself, did I save it? It starts shutting itself down. The screen goes dark. You stare at it in disbelief. You press the on-off button. Nothing. 1 hour to go, and the crew is coming round again with something they call a light snack. As you chew on a sub-zero temperature scone, you start to brighten up. You've got no work done. Your neighbours hate you. But you did drink canned wine while watching a film about a monkey and a monster.
Thank you for flying with us today. Please remember to take all your personal items with you, and we wish you a pleasant onward journey.
Not a bad flight, all in all.
That's all for this episode of The Intelligence. Let us know what you think of the show. You can get in touch at podcasts@economist.com. We'll see you back here tomorrow.
What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico is more than just a tropical paradise. It's an innovations paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, Puerto Rico has the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, this is the place to bring it. Find out more at investpr.org/economist.